He was. He went over and talked to him.
The waiter?
Yes.
He left the table. I don't know why I was pressing the point. It just seemed such an odd thing to do.
Yes, Charles said.
You didn't think that was strange?
Charles considered. Not really. The two of them spoke for a minute or two. I assumed Alan was complaining. After that, he went to the toilet. Then he came back to the table and we finished the meal.
I don't suppose you can describe the waiter. Do you know his name? At this stage, I didn't have a lot to go on, but it seemed to me that something must have been going on that evening when Alan met Charles. All sorts of strands come together and meet at that table. At the very moment when he handed over the manuscript, something had upset him, making him argumentative. He had behaved strangely, leaving the table to complain to a waiter about an accident that had nothing to do with him. The manuscript was missing pages, and 2 days later, he had died. I said nothing to Charles. I knew he would tell me that I was wasting my time. But later that afternoon, I walked down to the private members' club and set about talking my way in. It wasn't difficult. The receptionist told me that the police had been to the club only the day before, asking questions about Alan's behaviour, his state of mind. I was his editor. I was a friend of Charles Clover. Of course I could come in. I was shown up to the restaurant on the second floor. It was empty, the tables now being laid for dinner. The receptionist had given me the name of the waiter who'd had the accidents with the plates on that Friday, and he was waiting by the door as I came in.
That's right. I was meant to be working in the bar that evening, but they were short-staffed, so I came up and helped in the restaurant. The two gents were starting the main course when I came out the kitchen. They were sitting over in that corner.
Many of the waiters at the club are young and Eastern European, but Donald Lee was neither of those things. He was from Scotland, as became obvious the moment he spoke, and in his early 30s. He was from Glasgow, he said, married with a 2-year-old son. He'd been in London for 6 years and loved working at the Ivy.
You should see some of the people we get in here, especially when the theatres come down.
He was a short, stubby man, with the weight of life pressing down on his shoulders.
Not just writers, actors, politicians, the works.
I had told him who I was and why I was here. He had already been questioned by the police, and he gave me a shorthand version of what he had told them. Charles Clover and his guest had booked a table in the restaurant at 7:30 and had left shortly after 10. He hadn't served them. He didn't know what they had eaten, but he remembered that they had ordered an expensive bottle of wine.
Mr. Conway wasn't in a very good mood.
How do you know?
I'm just telling you. He didn't look happy.
He delivered his new novel that evening.
Did he? Well, bully for him. I didn't see it, but then I was in a noot. It was very busy, and as I said, we were short-staffed.
From the start, I'd had the impression that there was something he wasn't telling me.
You dropped some plates, I said.
He looked at me sullenly.
I'm never going to hear the end of it. What's the big deal?
I sighed. Look, Donald, can I call you that?
I'm off duty. You can call me what you like.
I just want to know what happened. I worked with him. I knew him well. And I didn't much like him, if you want the truth. Anything you tell me is just between the two of us. But I'm not convinced he killed himself. And if you know something, if you heard something, it really might help.
If you don't think he killed himself, what do you think?
I'll tell you if you tell me what you know. He thought for a moment.
You mind if I have a cigarette? He asked.
I'll join you, I said. The good old cigarettes again, breaking down the barriers, putting us on the same side. We left the restaurant. There was a smoker's area outside, a small square patio walled off from a disapproving world. We both lit up. I told him that my name was Susan, and once again promised him that this was just between the two of us. Suddenly, he was eager to talk.
You're a publisher, he said.
I'm an editor.
But you work for a publisher.
Yes.
Then maybe we can help each other.
He paused.
I knew Alan Conway. I knew who he was the moment I set eyes on him. And that's why I dropped those bloody plates. I forgot I was holding them,
and they burned through the serviette. How did you know him? He looked at me quite strangely.
Did you work on one of the Atticus Punt novels, Night Comes Calling?
It was the fourth in the series, the one set in a prep school.
I worked on all of them, I said.
What did you think of it?
Night Comes Calling has a headmaster killed during the performance of a play. He is sitting in the darkened auditorium when a figure runs through the audience, and the next thing you know, he's been stabbed with surgical precision in the side of the neck. What's clever is that the main suspects are all on stage at the time, so couldn't possibly have done it, although it turns out that one of them did. It takes place very shortly after the war, and there's a backstory involving cowardice and dereliction of duty.
I thought it was ingenious, I said.
It was my story. My idea. Donald Lee had intense brown eyes, and for a moment they came alive with anger.
Do you want me to go on?
Yes, please tell me.
All right.
He put the cigarette to his lips and sucked hard. The tip glowed a bright red.
I used to love books when I was a kid, he said. I always wanted to be a writer, even when I was at school.
It wasn't the sort of thing you admitted to at the school I went to, Bridgeton, east of Glasgow. Horrible bloody place, where they said you were queer if you used the library. That didn't bother me. I read all the time, as many books as I could get my hands on. Spy stories, Tom Clancy, Robert Ludlum, adventure stories, horror stories. I loved Stephen King. But best of all were detective stories. I couldn't get enough of them. I didn't go to university or anything like that. All I've ever wanted to do is write. And I'll get there one day, Susan, I'm telling you. I'm working on a book now. I'm only doing this job to keep me going until I get there. But the trouble was, it never worked out the way I wanted. When I started writing, I'd have this book in my head. I knew what I wanted to write. I got the ideas and the characters. But when I put it down on the page, it wouldn't come together. I tried and I tried and I just sat there, staring at the page. And then I'd rewrite. I could do it 50 times and it still wouldn't work. Anyway, 7 years ago, I saw this advertisement. There were these people who were offering weekend courses to help new writers. And there was one that was available, all the way down in bloody Devon. But it was focusing on murder mystery. That wasn't cheap. That was going to cost me 700 quid. But I'd saved up enough money, and I thought it was worth a shot. So I enrolled. I leaned forward and tapped ash into one of the neat silver receptacles the Ivy Club had provided. I knew where this was going. We all went to this farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, Lee went on. He was standing there with his hands balled into fists, as if he had been rehearsing, as if this was his moment on the stage. There were 11 of us in the group. A couple of them were complete tosses. And there were these two women who thought they were better than the rest of us. They'd had short stories published in magazines, so they were completely full of themselves. You probably meet people like that all the time. The rest of them were okay, though, and I really enjoyed being with them. You know, it made me realize that it wasn't just me, that we all had the same problems, and we were there for the same thing. There were 3 tutors running the course. Alan Conway was one of them. I thought he was really good. He drove a beautiful car, a BMW, and they put him up in a little house on his own. We were all sharing, but he still mucked in with the rest of us. He really knew what he was talking about, and of course he'd made a ton of money out of the Atticus Punt box. I'd read a couple of them before I went down there. I liked them, and they weren't that different from what I was trying to do. We had lectures and tutorials in the day. We ate together. In fact, everyone in the group had to help with the cooking. And there was plenty of booze in the evening, so we could just chat and unwind. That was my favourite part of it. We all felt like equals. Then one evening, there was just the two of us in this little snug area, and I told him about the book I was writing. His fists tightened as he came to the inevitable point of his narrative. If I give you my manuscript, will you read it? He asked.
It's a question I normally dread, but I bowed to the inevitable. Are you saying that Alan stole your ideas? I asked.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Susan. That's exactly what he did.
What's your book called?
Death Treads the Boards.
It was a terrible title, but of course I didn't say that. I can look at it for you, I said, but I can't promise I can help you.
All I want you to do is look at it. That's all I'm asking.
He looked me in the eye as if daring me to refuse.
I told Alan Conway my story, he went on. I told him all about the murder I'd thought up. It was late, and there were just the two of us in the room, no witnesses.
He asked me if he could look at the manuscript, and I was delighted. Everyone wanted him to read their work. That was the whole point. He finished his cigarette and ground it out, then promptly lit a second.
He read it very quickly. There were only 2 days of the course left, and on the last day he took me aside and gave me some advice. He said I used too many adjectives. He said my dialogue wasn't realistic.
What's realistic dialogue meant to sound like, for heaven's sake? It's not real. It's fiction.
He gave me some quite good ideas about my main character, my detective. I remember one of the things he said was that he should have a bad habit, like he should smoke or drink or something. He said he'd get in touch with me again, and I gave him my email address. I never heard from him. Not a word. And then, almost exactly a year later, Night Comes Calling came out in the shops. It was all about the production of a school play. My book wasn't set in a school. It was set in a theatre. But it was the same idea, and it didn't stop there. He'd nicked my murder. It was exactly the same. The same method, the same clues, almost the same characters. His voice was rising. That's what he did, Susan. He took my story and used it for Night Comes Calling.
Did you tell anyone? I asked. When the book came out, what did you do?
What could I do? You tell me. Who'd have believed me?
You could have written to us at Cloverleaf Books.
I did write to you. I wrote to the managing director, Mr. Clover. He didn't write back. I wrote to Alan Conway. I wrote to him quite a few times, as a matter of fact. Let's just say that I didn't hold back. But I got nothing from him either. I wrote to the people who set up the course in the first place. I got a letter from them. They gave me the brush off. They denied any responsibility, said it had nothing to do with them. I thought about going to the police. I mean, he'd stolen something from me. There's a word for that, isn't there? But when I talked to my wife, Karen, she said to forget it. He was famous, he was protected, I was nobody. She said it would just hurt my writing if I tried to fight it, and it was best to move on. So that's what I did. I'm still writing. At least I know I've got good ideas. He wouldn't have done what he did if I hadn't.
Have you written any other novels? I asked.
I'm working on one now, but it's not a detective story. I've moved on from that now. It's a children's book. Now that I've got a child, it felt like the right thing to do.
But you've kept Death Treads the Boards.
Of course I've kept it. I've kept everything I've ever written. I know I've got the talent. Karen loves my work, and one day, send it to me. I fished in my handbag and took out a card.
So what happened when you saw him in the restaurant? I asked.
He was waiting for me to give him my business card. It was a lifeline for him. I was in the ivory tower, and he was on the outside.
I've seen it in so many new writers, this belief that publishers are any different, smarter, more successful than them, when actually we're just shuffling along, hoping we'll still have a job at the end of the month.
I came out of the kitchen, he said. I was carrying 2 main courses and a side for table 9. I saw him, sitting there. He was arguing about something, and I was so shocked I just stood there. The plates were hot. They burned through the cloth and I dropped them.
And then? I was told that Alan came over. He was angry with you.
He shook his head. That's not how it happened. I cleaned up the mess and put a new order into the kitchen. I wasn't sure I wanted to go back into the room, but I had no choice, and at least I wasn't serving his table. Anyway, the next thing I know, Mr. Conway got up to go to the toilet, and he walked right past me. I wasn't going to say anything, but seeing him so close, inches away, I couldn't stop myself.
What did you say?
I said good evening,
I asked him if he remembered me. And he didn't. Or he pretended he didn't. I reminded him that we'd met in Devon, that he'd been kind enough to read my novel. He knew exactly who I was and what I was referring to. So then he got shetty with me. I don't come here to talk to waiters. That was what he said, those exact words. He asked me to step out of his way. He was keeping his voice low, but I knew exactly what he would do if I wasn't careful. It was the same thing all over again. He is successful with his fancy car and that big house of his up in Framlingham. I'm no one. He's a member here. I'm waiting tables. I need this job. I've got a 2-year-old kid. So I mumbled I was sorry and stepped away. It made me feel sick to my stomach doing that. But what choice did I have? You must have been quite pleased to hear he was dead. You want the truth, Susan? I was delighted. I couldn't have been happier if... He had said too much, but I pressed him anyway. If what? It doesn't matter. That we both knew what he'd meant. I gave him the business card, and he tucked it away in his top pocket. He finished his second cigarette and stubbed that one out too. Can I ask you one last thing? I said, as we moved back inside. You said that Alan was having an argument. I don't suppose you heard anything of what was being said. He shook his head. I wasn't near enough. How about the people at the next table? I had seen for myself the layout of the room. They would have been virtually rubbing shoulders. I suppose that's possible. I can tell you who they were if you like. Their names will still be on the system. He left the terrace and went back into the restaurant to do just that. I watched him as he walked into the distance, remembering what he had just said. That big house of his up in Framlingham. He hadn't had to look up the name of the town. He already knew where Alan lived. The grandson. The man who had been sitting at the table next to Alan Conway that night, and who might or might not have overheard the conversation, was called Matthew Pritchard. It was very curious. His name may not be familiar to you, but I recognized it at once. Matthew Pritchard is the grandson of Agatha Christie. He was famously given the rights to the Mousetrap when he was 9 years old. It feels odd to be writing about him, and it may seem unlikely that he should have been there. But he is a member of the club. The offices of Agatha Christie Limited are a short walk away in Drury Lane, and as I've already mentioned, the Mousetrap is still showing at St. Martin's Theatre, which is just down the road. I had his number on my mobile. We had met 2 or 3 times at literary events, and a few years ago I had been in negotiations to buy his memoir, The Grand Tour. It was a very entertaining account of a round-the-world trip his grandmother had made in 1922. I was outbid by HarperCollins. I called him, and he remembered me at once. "Of course, Susan. Lovely to hear from you. How are you?" I wasn't quite sure how to explain myself. Again, the fact that I was involving him in a real-life mystery that I was investigating struck me as bizarre, and I didn't really want to go into all that on the phone. So I simply mentioned the death of Alan Conway, he knew all about that, and said there was something I wanted to ask him about. That was enough. As it happened, he was close by. He gave me the name of a cocktail bar near Seven Dials, and we agreed to meet there for a drink that evening. If there is one word I would use to describe Matthew, it is affable. He must be about 70, and looking at him, with his ruffled white hair and slightly ruddy complexion, you get the sense that he has lived life to the full. He has a laugh that you can hear across the room, a raucous sailor's laugh that sounds as if he has just been told the filthiest joke. He was looking immaculate in a blazer and an open-neck shirt as he wandered into the cocktail bar, and although I offered, he insisted on paying for the drinks. We talked a little about Alan Conway. He expressed his sympathies, said how much he had always enjoyed the books. "Very, very clever, always surprising, full of good ideas." I remember the words exactly, because there was a nasty part of me that was wondering if it might be possible to slip them onto the back cover. Agatha Christie's grandson endorsing Alan Conway's work could only be a good thing for future sales. He asked me how Alan had died, and I told him that the police suspected suicide. He looked pained at that. A man so full of life himself, he would find it hard to understand anyone who could choose to do away with theirs. I added that Alan had been seriously ill, and he nodded as if that made some kind of sense. "You know, I saw him a week or so ago at the Ivy," he said. "That was what I wanted to ask you about," I replied. "He was having dinner with his publisher."
"Yes, that's right. I was at the next table."
"I'd be interested to know what you saw or heard."
"Why don't you ask him?"
"I have. Charles has told me a certain amount, but I'm trying to fill in the gaps."
"Well, I wasn't really listening to the conversation. Of course, the tables are quite close to each other, but I can't tell you very much of what was said."
I found it rather endearing that Matthew hadn't asked me why I was interested in what had happened. He had lived much of his life in the world created by his grandmother, and the way he saw it, detectives asked questions, witnesses answered them. It was as simple as that. I reminded him of the moment when Lee had dropped the plates, and he smiled.
"Yes, I do remember that. As a matter of fact, I did hear some of what they were saying just before it happened, raised voices and all that. They were talking about the title of his new book."
Alan delivered it that night.
"Magpie Murders. I'm sure you'll understand, Susan. I can't hear the word murder without my ears pricking up." He chortled at that. "They were arguing about the title. I think your publisher chap made some comment. Mr. Conway wasn't at all happy." "Yes. He'd said he'd planned the title years ago. I heard him say that, and he banged his fist on the table, made the cutlery jump. That was when I turned round and realized who he was. It hadn't actually dawned on me until then. Anyway, there was a moment's silence, a couple of seconds, perhaps, and then he pointed his finger and said, 'I'm not having the—'"
"The what?" I asked. Pritchard smiled at me.
"I'm afraid I can't help you, because that was when the waiter dropped the plates. It made an absolutely terrible din. The entire room came to a halt. You know how it is. The poor chap went quite red, I'm talking about the waiter now, and started clearing up the mess. I'm afraid I didn't really hear any more after that. I'm sorry."
"Did you see Alan get up?" I asked.
"Yes, I think he went to the loo."
"He talked to the waiter?"
"You might have done, but I don't remember anything more. In fact, I'd finished my meal by then and I left shortly afterwards."
"I'm not having the—" That was what it boiled down to. Four words that could have meant anything. I made a mental note to ask Charles about it the next time I saw him. Pritchard and I talked about his grandmother as we finished our cocktails. It had always amused me how much she had come to hate Hercule Poirot by the time she finished writing about him. What had she famously called him? "A detestable, bombastic, tiresome, egocentric little creep." Hadn't she once said that she wanted to exorcise herself of him? He laughed.
"I think that, like all geniuses, she wanted to write all sorts of different books, and she got very frustrated when her publishers only wanted, at one stage, for her to write Poirot. She got very impatient when she was told what to do."
We got up. I had ordered a gin and tonic, and it must have been a double because it made my head spin. "Thank you for your help," I said.
"I don't think I've been much help at all," he replied, "but I'll look forward to seeing the new book when it comes out. As I say, I always liked the Atticus Punt mysteries, and Mr. Conway was obviously a great devotee of my grandmother's work."
"He had the complete collection in his office," I said.
"I'm not surprised. He borrowed lots of things from her, you know. Names, places. It was almost like a game. I'm sure he did it quite deliberately. But when I was reading the books, I'd find all sorts of references buried in the text. I'm quite certain he was doing it on purpose. And I did sometimes think of writing to him, to ask him what he was up to."
Pritchard smiled one last time. He was too good-natured to accuse Alan of plagiarism, although it was a strange echo of my conversation with Donald Lee. We shook hands. I went back to the office, closed my door, and took the manuscript out to examine it one more time. He was right. Magpie Murders pays quiet homage to Agatha Christie at least half a dozen times, For example, Sir Magnus Pye and his wife stay at the Hotel Genevieve in Cap Ferrat. There's a villa in The Murder on the Links that has the same name. The Blue Boar is the pub in Bristol, where Robert Blakiston is involved in a fight. But it also appears in St. Mary Mead, home of Miss Marple. Lady Pye and Jack Dartford have lunch at Carlotta's, which seems to have been named after the American actress in Lord Edgware Dies. There's a joke, of sorts, on page 124. Fraser fails to notice a dead man on the 3:50 train from Paddington, an obvious reference to the 4:50 from Paddington. Mary Blakiston lives in Shepherd's Farm. Dr. James Shepherd is the narrator of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which is set in King's Abbot, a village that is also mentioned on page 62, which is where old Dr. Renard is buried. For that matter, the entire mechanism of Magpie Murders, the use of the old nursery rhyme, deliberately imitates a device that Christie used many times. She liked children's verse. 1, 2, buckle my shoe, 5 little pigs, 10 little Indians, and then there were none, as it later became, Hickory Dickory Dock. All of them appear in her work. You would have thought that any writer whose work has a similarity to another author much better known than himself would do everything he could to disguise the fact. Alan Conway, in his own peculiar way, seems to do the exact opposite. What exactly was going on in his mind when he put these obvious signposts in? Or to put it another way, what exactly were they pointing to? Not for the first time, I got the sense that he had been trying to tell me something, that he hadn't just written the Atticus Punt mysteries to entertain people. He had created them for a purpose that was slowly becoming clear. The Road to Framlingham. The following Friday, I drove back to Suffolk for Alan Conway's funeral. Neither me nor Charles had been invited, and it was unclear who actually was making the arrangements, James Taylor, Claire Jenkins, or Sajid Khan. I'd been tipped off by my sister, who had read about it in the local newspaper, and emailed me with the time and the place. She told me that the funeral was being conducted by the Reverend Tom Robeson, vicar of St. Michael's Church, and Charles and I decided to drive up together. We took my car. I was going to stop a little longer. Andreas had been staying with me all week, and he was annoyed that I wasn't going to be around at the weekend. But I needed time alone. The whole question of Crete was hanging over us, and although we hadn't discussed it again, I knew he was waiting for an answer that I wasn't yet ready to give. Anyway, I couldn't stop thinking about Alan's death. I was convinced that another few days in Framlingham would lead me both to the discovery of the missing chapters and, more broadly, the truth of what had happened at Abbey Grange. I was quite sure that the two were related. Alan must have been killed because of something in his book. It might well be that if I could find out who had killed Sir Magnus Pye, I'd know who had killed him, or vice versa. The funeral started at 3. Charles and I left London just after midday, and from the very start I knew it was a mistake. We should have gone by train. The traffic was horrible, and Charles looked awkward in the low-slung seat of my MGB. I felt uneasy myself, and was wondering why, until it dawned on me, just as we hit the M25, that the two of us had always had a face-to-face relationship. That is, I would meet him in his office, and he would be one side of the desk, and I would be on the other. We would eat together, facing each other in restaurants. We were often on opposite sides of the conference table. But here we were, unusually, side by side, and I was simply less familiar with his profile. Being so near to him was also peculiar. Of course we'd been in taxis together and occasionally on trains, but somehow my little classic car brought us much closer than I would have liked. I had never noticed how unhealthy his skin looked, how years of shaving had scraped the life out of his cheeks and neck. He was dressed in a dark suit with a formal shirt, and I was slightly fascinated by his Adam's apple, which seemed to be constrained, bulging over his black tie. He was going back to London on his own, and I rather wished I'd been a little less forward of my invitation and allowed him to do the same both ways. Still, we chatted pleasantly enough once we'd left the worst of the traffic behind us. I was more relaxed by the time we hit the A12 and picked up speed. I mentioned that I'd met Matthew Pritchard, which amused him, and that allowed me to ask him once again about his dinner at the Ivy Club, and in particular about the argument concerning the title, Magpie Murders. I didn't want him to feel that I was interrogating him, and I still wasn't sure why that last conversation meant so much to me. Charles was also puzzled by my interest. "I told you I didn't like the title," he said simply. "I thought it was too similar to Midsummer Murders on TV. You asked him to change it.
"Yes."
"And he refused.
"That's right. He got quite angry about it."
I reminded him of what Alan had said, the four words he had spoken just before the waiter had dropped the plates.
"I'm not having the..."
Did he know what Alan had been about to say?
"No, I can't remember, Susan. I have no idea."
"Did you know that he thought up the title years ago?"
"I didn't." "How do you know?"
In fact, Matthew Pritchard had overheard Alan telling him exactly that. "I think he mentioned it to me once," I lied. We didn't talk about Alan much more after that. Neither of us was looking forward to the funeral. Well, of course, you never do. But in Alan's case, we were only going out of a sense of obligation, although I was interested to know who would be there. I'd actually called James Taylor that morning. We were going to have dinner later that evening at the Crown Hotel. I also wondered if Melissa Conway would show up. It had been several years since I had met her, and after what Andreas had said, I was keen to see her again, the three of them together at Woodbridge School, where Atticus Punt had begun. We drove in silence for about 20 minutes, but then, just after we had entered the county of Suffolk, a sign helpfully informing us that was what we'd done, Charles suddenly announced,
"I'm thinking of stepping aside."
"I'm sorry?" I would have stared at him, except that I was in the process of overtaking a monster four-axle lorry, complete with tow bar trailer, possibly on its way to Felixstowe.
"I've been meaning to talk to you for some time, Susan, before this business with Alan. I suppose that's the last nail in the coffin, if that's not a horribly inappropriate expression given the circumstances. But I'll be 65 soon, and Elaine has been on at me to slow down."
Elaine, I may have mentioned, was his wife. I had only ever met her a couple of times, and knew she had little interest in the publishing world.
And then, of course, there's the new baby on its way. Becoming a grandfather certainly makes you think. It just might be the right time.
How soon? I didn't know what to say. The idea of Cloverleaf Books without Charles Clover was unthinkable. He was as much a part of the place as the wood panelling.
Maybe next spring?
He paused.
I was wondering if you might like to take over.
What, me? As CEO?
Why not? I'll stay on as chairman, so I'll still have some involvement, but you'll take over the day-to-day running. You know the business as well as anyone. And let's face it, if I were to parachute someone in, I'm not sure you'd be happy working with them. He was right about that. I was hurtling through my 40s, and I was vaguely aware that the older I got, the more stuck in my ways I became.
I suppose it's something that happens in publishing, where people often stay in the same job for a very long time. I wasn't good with new people. Could I do it? I knew about books, but I had no real interest in the rest of it. Employees, accountants, overheads, long-term strategy, the day-to-day running of a medium-sized business. At the same time, it occurred to me that this was my second job offer in less than a week. I could become CEO of Cloverleaf, or I could run a small hotel in Ios Nikolaos. It was quite a choice. Would I have complete autonomy? I asked.
Yes, we'd come to some sort of financial agreement, but effectively it would be your company.
He smiled.
It changes your priorities, becoming a grandfather. Tell me you'll consider it.
Of course I will, Charles. It's very kind of you to have such confidence in me. We stayed silent for the next 10 or 20 miles. I'd misjudged the amount of time I needed to get out of London, and it looked as if we were going to be late for the funeral. In fact, we would have been if Charles hadn't warned me to take a right cutting round through Branderston, and so missing the roadworks that had held me up at Earl Soham the last time I had come through. That saved us a quarter of an hour, and we pulled into Framlingham comfortably at 2:50. I'd booked the same room at the Crown, so I was able to leave the MGB in their car park. They were already setting up the front lounge for drinks after the funeral, and we just had time to snatch a coffee, then hurried out the front entrance and across the road. There was going to be a funeral. The first words of Magpie Murders. The irony wasn't lost on me as I joined the other mourners who were assembling round the open grave. The Church of St. Michael the Archangel, to give it its full name, is really much too large for the town in which it finds itself. But then the whole of Suffolk is studded with monumental buildings, locked in combat with the surrounding landscape, as if each parish felt a need to bully its way into people's lives. It feels uncomfortable, not just penned in, but in the wrong place altogether. As you glance back through the cast iron gates, it's surprising to find yourself looking across a busy street to Mr. Chan's Chinese restaurant. There's something odd about the cemetery, too. It's slightly raised up, so that the dead bodies are actually buried above street level. And the grass is too green. The graves cluster together in irregular lines, with so much space around them that there's no economy of scale. The cemetery is both too full and too empty at the same time. And yet this was where Alan had chosen to be buried. I guessed that he had selected his plot with some care. It was right in the middle, between two Irish yew trees. Nobody would be able to miss it as they made their way to the church. His closest neighbours had died almost a century before him, and the newly dug earth appeared as a fresh scar, as if it had no right to be there. The weather had changed during the course of the day. The sun had been shining when we left London, but now the sky was grey and there was a thin drizzle sweeping through the air. I understood why Alan had started Magpie Murders with a funeral. It had been a useful device, introducing all the main characters in a way that had allowed him to consider them at leisure. I was able to do the same now. I was quite surprised how many of them I knew. First, there was James Taylor, wrapped in a black designer raincoat, with his damp hair sticking to his neck, and looking for all the world as if he had just stepped out of a spy novel. He was doing his best to look somber and composed, but there was a smile about him that he could not control, not on his lips, but in his eyes and the very way he stood. Sajid Khan was standing next to him, holding an umbrella. The two of them had arrived together. Sir James had inherited. He knew that Alan had failed to sign his most recent will, and Abbey Grange and everything else was his. That was interesting. James saw me and nodded, and I smiled back at him. I don't know why, but I was really glad for him, and it didn't even bother me, the thought that Alan might have died at his hand. Claire Jenkins was there. She was dressed in black and crying, really sobbing, with the tears coursing down her cheeks, helped on their way by the rain. She was holding a handkerchief, but it must have been useless by now. A man stood next to her, awkwardly holding her arm with a gloved hand. I had not met him before, but would easily remember him when I saw him again. For a start, he was black, the only black person to come to the funeral. He also had an extraordinary physical presence, very well built, with solid arms and shoulders, a thick neck, intense eyes. I thought at first that he might be an ex-wrestler. He had the build. But then it occurred to me that he was more likely to be a policeman. Claire had told me that she worked for the Suffolk Constabulary. Was this the elusive Detective Superintendent Locke, whose inquiry had been parallel tracking my own? My eyes settled on another man, who was standing on his own with the church tower rising monstrously behind him, too big for a church that was too big for its town. It was his Hunter Wellington boots I noticed first. They were brand new and bright orange, an odd choice for a funeral. I couldn't see much of his face. He was wearing a cloth cap and a barber jacket turned up at the collar. As I watched him, his mobile phone rang, and instead of putting it on silent, he took the call, turning away for privacy. John White. I heard him give his name, but nothing else. Still, I knew who he was. This was Alan's neighbour, the hedge fund manager he'd fallen out with just before he died. Still waiting for the service to begin, I searched through the crowd and found Melissa Conway and her son standing next to the cemetery's war memorial. She was wearing a raincoat, tucked so tightly around her that it appeared to be breaking her in half. Her hands were deep in her pockets, her hair concealed beneath a scarf. I might not have recognized her, but for her son, who must have been in his late teens now. He was the spitting image of his father, at least in Alan's later incarnation, uncomfortable in a dark suit that was a little too large for him. He was not happy to be here, by which I mean he was angry. He was staring at the grave with something like murder in his eyes. I hadn't seen Melissa for at least 6 years. She had come to the launch party of Atticus Punt Takes the Case, which had been held at the German embassy in London, an evening of champagne and miniature bratwurst. I was seeing Andreas occasionally by then, and because we had him in common, we were able to strike up a conversation of sorts. I remember her as being polite, but disengaged. It can't be much fun being married to a writer, and she made it clear that she was only there because it was expected of her. She knew nobody in the room, and nobody had anything to say to her. It was a shame that the two of us had never met properly at Woodbridge School. I had no knowledge of her outside her relation to Alan. She had the same blank look on her face now, even though it was a coffin rather than canapes that was being brought in. I wondered why she had come. The hearse had arrived. The coffin was carried forward. A vicar appeared, walking out of the church. This was the Reverend Tom Robeson, whose name had been mentioned in the newspaper. He was about 50 years old, and although I had never seen him before, I knew him immediately. His tombstone face and his long, slightly unkempt hair. That was how Alan had described Robin Osborne in Magpie Murders, and even as I thought that, something else occurred to me. I had seen it as I entered the cemetery, his name written on a sign. It helped, having that visual prompt. Robeson is an anagram of Osborne. It was another one of Alan's private jokes. James Taylor had become James Fraser. Claire was Clarissa. And now that I thought about it, John White, the hedge fund manager, had been turned into Johnny Whitehead, the second-hand furniture dealer and petty crook. This the result of an argument about money. As far as I knew, Alan had never been a religious person, despite this very conventional funeral, and I had to ask myself what his relationship with the vicar has been, and why had he chosen to celebrate it in his novel. Osborne had been number 3 on my list of suspects. Mary Blakiston had discovered some sort of secret left out on his desk. Could Robeson have had a reason to murder Alan? He certainly looked the part of the vengeful killer, with his rather grim, colourless features and his robes hanging forlornly off him in the rain. He described Alan as a popular writer whose books had given pleasure to many millions of people around the world. It was as if Alan was being introduced on a Radio 4 panel show rather than at his own funeral. Alan Conway may have left us all too soon and in tragic circumstances, but he will, I am sure, remain in the hearts and the minds of the literary community. Even ignoring the question of whether the literary community actually had a heart, I thought this was unlikely to be the case. It's my experience that dead authors are forgotten with remarkable speed. Even living authors find it hard to stay on the shelves. There are too many new books and too few shelves. Alan was one of our country's most celebrated mystery writers, he went on. He lived much of his life in Suffolk, and it was always his wish that he should be buried here. In Magpie Murders, there is something hidden in the funeral address that relates in some way to the murder. On the very last page of the typescript, when Punt is talking about the clues that will solve the crime, he specifically refers to the words spoken by the vicar. Unfortunately, Robeson's speech was almost deliberately bland and unrevealing. He didn't mention James or Melissa. There was nothing about friendship, generosity, humour, personal mannerisms, small kindnesses, special moments, All those things we actually miss when somebody dies. If Alan had been a marble statue stolen from a park, the Reverend Tom Robeson might have cared as much. There was just one passage that stayed with me. It certainly struck me that it might be worth asking the vicar about it later.
"Very few people are now buried in this churchyard," he said. But Alan insisted. He had given a great deal of money to the church, which allowed us to undertake much-needed restoration work to the clerestory windows and the main chancel arch. In return, he demanded this resting place, and who was I to stand in his way? He smiled, as if trying to make light of what he had just said. All his life, Alan had a dominant personality, as I discovered at quite an early age. Certainly, I was not going to refuse him this last wish. His contribution assures the future of St. Michael's, and it is only fitting that he should remain here within the church grounds.
This whole section of the speech had an edge to it. On the one hand, Alan had been generous. He deserved to be allowed to lie there. But that wasn't quite the case, was it? Alan had demanded it. He had a dominant personality, and, as I discovered at quite an early age. Alan and the vicar obviously had some sort of history. Was I really the only person who noticed the discordance in what was being said? I was going to ask Charles what he thought as soon as the service was over, but in fact, I never made it to the end. The rain was beginning to ease off, and Robeson had reached his closing remarks. Bizarrely, he had forgotten Alan altogether. He was talking about the history of Framlingham, and in particular Thomas Howard, the third Duke of Norfolk, whose tomb was inside the church. For a moment my attention wandered, and that was when I noticed a mourner who must have arrived late. He was lingering over by the gate, watching the service from a distance, anxious to be on his way. Even as I examined him, and with the vicar still speaking, he turned on his heels and walked out onto Church Street. I had not seen his face. He was wearing a black fedora hat. "Don't leave," I whispered to Charles. "I'll meet you at the hotel." It had taken Atticus Punt 130 pages to discover the identity of the man who had attended Mary Blakiston's funeral. I couldn't wait that long. Nodding at the vicar and detaching myself from the crowd, I set off in pursuit. The Atticus Adventures. I caught up with the man in the fedora hat at the corner of Church Street, just where it met Market Square. Now that he had escaped from the cemetery, he no longer seemed to be in such a hurry to get away. It helped that the drizzle had finally eased off, and there were even a few patches of bright sun illuminating the puddles. He was taking his time, and I was able to catch my breath before I approached him. Some instinct made him turn, and he saw me.
"Yes?"
"I was at the funeral," I said.
"So was I."
I wondered. It was only then that it dawned on me that I had no earthly idea what I was going to say. It was all far too difficult to explain. I was investigating a murder which, as far as I knew, nobody else was aware had taken place. I had chased after him only because of his choice of headgear, the relevance of which was tangential, to say the least. I drew a breath. "My name is Susan Ryland," I said. "I was Alan's editor at Cloverleaf Books."
"Cloverleaf?"
He knew the name.
"Yes. We've spoken a few times."
"Have we?"
"Not you. There's a woman there, Lucy Butler." Lucy was our rights manager. She had the office next to mine. I've talked to her about Atticus Punt.
Suddenly, I had a good idea who I was talking to, but I didn't need to ask.
"I'm Mark Redmond," he said. Charles and I had often talked about Redmond and his company, Red Herring Productions, during our weekly conferences. He was a TV and film producer, and it was he who had optioned the rights to the Atticus Punt novels, which he was developing with the BBC. Lucy had visited him at his offices in Soho and had reported back favourably. A young, enthusiastic staff, a shelf full of BAFTAs, phones ringing, dispatch riders in and out, a sense that this was a company that made things happen.
As the name suggested, Red Herring specialized in murder mystery. Redmond had started his career as a runner on Bergerac, presumably running all over Jersey, which is where it was set. From there, he'd moved on to another half dozen shows before setting up on his own. Atticus would be his first independent production. From what I understood, the BBC was very keen. He was actually someone I was very glad to meet. His future and mine were intertwined. A television series would give the books a whole new life. There would be new covers, new publicity, a complete relaunch. We needed it more than ever, given our problems with Magpie Murders. I still had Charles's offer to consider. If I really was going to take over the running of Cloverleaf Books, I would need its star author, and posthumously was good enough for me. Red Herring Productions might make it possible. He was about to leave for London. He had a car and a driver waiting for him in the square. But I persuaded him to talk to me first, and we went into a little cafe opposite the hotel. We had less chance of our being disturbed there. He had taken off the fedora to reveal slicked back dark hair and narrow eyes. He was a handsome man, slim, expensively dressed. He had built his career in television, and there was something of the TV personality about him. I could imagine him presenting a program. It would be about lifestyle, or maybe finance. I ordered two coffees, and we began to talk. "You left the funeral early," I said.
"I wasn't sure why I came, if you want the truth. I felt I ought to be there since I'd been working with him. But once I arrived, I decided it was a mistake. I didn't know anyone, and it was cold and wet. I just wanted to leave."
"When did you last see him?"
"Why do you want to know?" I shrugged, as if it wasn't important. "I just wondered. Alan's suicide has obviously come as a great shock to us, and we're trying to work out why he did it." "I saw him 2 weeks ago."
"In London?"
"No, actually, I went out to his home. It was a Saturday."
"The day before Alan died." "Had he invited you?" I asked.
Redmond laughed briefly. "I wouldn't have driven the whole bloody way if he hadn't. He wanted to talk about the series, and he asked me to dinner. Knowing Alan, I thought it best not to refuse. He'd been difficult enough already, and I didn't want to have any more rows."
"What sort of rows?"
He looked at me disdainfully. "I'm sure I don't need to tell you that Alan was a real piece of work," he said. "You say you were his editor? Don't tell me he didn't give you the runaround. I almost wish I'd never heard of Atticus Punt. He was making life so bloody difficult for me, I could have murdered him myself."
"I'm so sorry," I said. "I had no idea. What exactly was the problem?"
"It was one thing after another."
The coffees arrived, and he stirred his, the spoon making endless circles as he went through the process of working with Alan Conway.
Getting him to sign the option in the first place was hard enough. The amount of money he was asking, you'd think he was J.K. bloody Rowling. And don't forget, this was risk money, as far as I was concerned. At the time, I didn't have a deal with the BBC, and the whole thing could have gone west. But that was just the start of it. He wouldn't go away. He wanted to be an executive producer. Well, that's not so unusual. But he also insisted on adapting the book himself, even though he had no TV writing experience, and I can tell you, the BBC weren't at all happy about that. He wanted casting approval. That was the biggest headache of all. No author ever gets casting approval. Consultancy, maybe. But that wasn't good enough. He had ridiculous ideas. Do you know who he wanted to play Atticus Punt?
"Ben Kingsley," I suggested. He stared at me.
"Did he tell you?"
"No, but I know he was a fan."
"Well, you're right. Unfortunately, it was out of the question. Kingsley would never take the part. And anyway, he's 73, much too old. We argued about that, we argued about everything. I wanted to start with Night Comes Calling. It's much the best book, in my view. But he wasn't having that, either. He wouldn't explain why not. He just said he didn't want to do it. The option comes to an end quite soon, so I had to be careful what I said."
"Will you still go ahead?" I asked. Now that he's gone? Redmond visibly brightened. He put down his spoon and drank some of his coffee. I'll go ahead with it because he's gone. Can I be honest with you, Susan? I shouldn't speak ill of the dead, but frankly, his departure is the best thing that could have happened. I've already spoken to James Taylor. He owns the rights now, and he seems pleasant enough. He's already agreed to give us another year, and by that time, we should have the whole thing set up. We're hoping to make all 9 books. He didn't finish the last one. We can deal with that. It doesn't matter. They've made 104 episodes of Midsummer Murders, but the original author only wrote 7 books. And look at Sherlock. They're doing things Doyle never dreamed of. With a bit of luck, we'll do 12 seasons of the Atticus Adventures. That's what we're going to call it. I never much liked the name Punt. It sounds a bit too foreign, and you may not agree with me, but I think the umlaut on the U is really off-putting. But Atticus is good. It reminds me of To Kill a Mockingbird. Now we can go ahead and get a decent writer in, and that'll make my life a whole lot easier. Haven't the public had enough of murder? I asked. You're joking. Inspector Morse, Taggart, Lewis, Foyle's War, Endeavour, A Touch of Frost, Luther, the Inspector Linley Mysteries, Cracker, Broadchurch, and even bloody Maygray and Wallander. British TV would disappear into a dot on the screen without murder. They're even bumping people off in the soap operas. And it's the same the world over. You know, they say in America that the average child sees 8,000 murders before they leave elementary school. Makes you think, doesn't it? He finished the rest of his coffee, as if he was suddenly anxious to be on his way. So what did Alan Conway want, I asked him, when you saw him 2 weeks ago? He shrugged. He complained about the lack of progress. He had no idea how the BBC works. It can take them weeks to answer the phone. The fact of the matter is that they didn't like his script. Of course I hadn't told him that. We were trying to find someone else to take over. Did you talk about the option? Yes. He hesitated for a moment. The first time I had seen any flaw in the armour of his self-confidence. He told me there was another production company he was talking to. It didn't matter that I'd already invested thousands in the Atticus Adventures. He was quite ready to start all over again. So what happened? I asked. We had lunch at his house. It didn't get off to a great start. I was late. I got held up at some endless roadworks at Earl Soham. He said it had been like that for weeks, and he was in a bad mood. Anyway, we talked. I made my pitch. He promised to get back to me. I left about 3 in the afternoon and drove home. He glanced down at his empty cup. He was keen to be on his way. Thank you for the coffee. It's very nice to meet you. As soon as we get a green light for production, I'll let you know. Mark Redmond walked out, leaving me to pay for the coffee. I could have murdered him myself. I didn't need to be a fan of Midsummer Murders to recognize a motive when I heard one. And it occurred to me that when it came to suspects, in the league of sheer bloody obviousness, Redmond had just put himself at the top of the list. Even so, there was one thing I wasn't expecting. Later that afternoon, when I signed into the Crown, I flicked back a few pages in the guest registry. I was acting on a whim. But there it was. Mark Redmond's name. He had booked into the hotel and stayed there 2 nights. When I asked the receptionist, she remembered him leaving after breakfast on Monday morning, he and his wife. He hadn't mentioned that she'd been there too. But that wasn't relevant. The fact was that he had actually been in Framlingham at the time Alan died. In other words, he'd been lying. I could think of only one good reason why. After the funeral. The reception rooms were crowded by the time I got to the Crown. There had only been about 40 people at the funeral, and it had felt a little sparse. But in the confines of the front lounge, with 2 fires blazing, red and white wine circulating, trays of sandwiches and sausage rolls laid out, There was something close enough to a party atmosphere, and even a few of the hotel guests had joined in on the grounds that free wine and